This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han. And a new week has begun.
Indeed. And good morning.
And a new day. We're taking it all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. It is the 12th of February, 2018.
Short month, short week as well. 4 days till Chinese New Year, if you are keeping score at home.
And you should, because there's nothing more exciting than a long weekend, except a longer weekend. And because I know there's a lot of chatter about how if only Chinese New Year has fallen on the Thursday, we would have had a four-day weekend. If it had fallen on a Monday, we would have had Monday and Tuesday off and a four-day weekend. But it didn't. So what can we do?
Well, that's just human nature, isn't it? It's never enough. We have unlimited wants.
It's true. It's true.
Insatiable.
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 No, insatiable? Yeah, insatiable.
Anyways.
Okay, so there we have it. As you slept soundly, lots of things happened. The world kept turning. Some of it not so happy news, and we'll have some of that for you. Look, hedgehogs, which is a creature that's become quite mythical in Britain. You know, they're in stories and stuff, hedgehogs. Well, they're continuing to decline. Apparently, their populations have halved by 50% since the turn of the century.
Yeah, and apparently this drop in the hedgehog population is primarily in the rural areas. However, there are signs that the hedgehog population in the urban areas may be recovering.
Yeah, so and because of particular initiatives that have been taken to promote environments in which they can nest and reproduce themselves.
Right. And I also think that given the rise in popularity of hedgehogs as pets now, I think that may go some ways towards the conservation of the hedgehog population.
I think. But because a pet is not the same as a wild creature in the environment contributing to the ecosystem.
If you're just counting hedgehog heads.
Okay. Also in the news, a Russian passenger plane crashed near Moscow soon after takeoff, killing some 71 people on board. Thus far, no survivors reported. Quite sad. And I wonder, Han, as you were wondering, was this the first crash of the year when it comes to airplanes?
Yeah, this appears to be the first commercial plane, the first fatal commercial plane crash for 2018. There was another smaller plane crash with 10 people, two families on board off Costa Rica. That actually happened on New Year's Eve. Now, this crash in Russia comes after industry groups lauded 2017 to be the safest year, one of the safest years for commercial passenger air travel. 2018 off to not such a good start.
Okay, in Iran, a prominent environmentalist, he was a Canadian-Iranian, was found dead in his prison cell. He'd been arrested, apparently, for spying. If you remember, you know, the last couple of years, we've had some celebrated cases of foreign individuals arrested on, you know, with charges of espionage. So, see, this is he's a prominent environmentalist, and I think the family remains quite bewildered as to the reason why he might have committed suicide.
Right, and not just the family that's reacting in disbelief, but also members within the activist community in Iran. They are also wondering, you know, how could someone as celebrated as him take his own life? They are questioning the official record as to the cause of the suicide.
And also, speaking of death, prominent Pakistani human rights activist and lawyer Asma Jahangir has died at the age of 66. News that was greeted with laments from around the world, remembering what a prominent role she played over the last couple of decades in promoting human rights and the rule of law in Pakistan. We'll be back with more. We have a look at Mike Pence. Yes, he's the vice president of the United States, and see how he stacks up in terms of statesmanship globally. Okay, stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was America with Riverside. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. And the morning run continues. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Include your name so we know who you are. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Han, time to talk about the Olympics. something that excites you, the Winter Olympics?
Not quite.
Yeah, because I guess we don't really think about those games. I don't know if Malaysia's even participating.
Well, I think we do have one participant there, figure skating. Don't quote me on that one. I think since the Jamaican bobsled team, my interest in the Winter Olympics has waned drastically.
Okay.
Cool Runnings, if you remember that movie.
Yes, I do, in fact. Now, you know, this Olympic Games marked by an extraordinary diplomatic move after a year of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The North reached out to the South and said, why don't we have a joint team? And so when the unified Korean team entered the stadium at the opening ceremonies recently, there was a huge cheer. In fact, everybody got to their feet except the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, and his wife, Karen. Now, your White House officials, speaking on conditions of anonymity, told the Associated Press that Pence stood only for the U.S. team, despite other people in the box standing and applauding when athletes from the two Koreas walked together. Now, Pence was seated next to South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And one wonders, really, about that move. Was it a protest? Was Pence just thinking that he didn't have to acknowledge this? And was this just a personal thing, or was it an American statement about the particular, gesture?
Well, if you get into the current stance of the U.S. administration, America first, these kinds of displays pretty much falls in line with that kind of outlook. Eh? So it's not really that surprising. Now, granted, it certainly it's an about turn from what you would expect from states more, you know, visiting politicians, especially in someone else's country, to kind of toe the line and have some level or adhere to some level of decorum. But in this case, Pence obviously saw it fit to do otherwise.
Yeah, so what is it that Trump has unleashed in not just ordinary people, but the political establishment, a kind of, I just do it. I'll be real, for instance. I mean, so some people might like it because they think, oh, he's not just doing what's expected. He's not, conforming to formalities. He's actually expressing his true feelings. Like, he doesn't care that North Korea and South Korea have gotten to this extraordinary moment. He doesn't care, because maybe he was upset by, a whole year full of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Mm. And so he's just going to express it. He's going to sit this one out,
Well, I mean, he did say that he was going to go about revealing the true North Korea at every stop. In other words, pretty much every chance that he got. Now, to think that this display is somewhat, it is new, right? And I guess there is an element of shock and awe to it. But if I can draw upon my experience in the States and spending over 7 years in Trump land, very often the criticism against U.S. foreign policy is that the U.S., despite its vast influence, they are seen to be meek and they're always kowtowing to, these intergovernmental bodies and et cetera, right? So now I think Trump and his officials are now pandering to his base and really trumpeting that American first slogan.
Okay,
taken to an extreme.
Right? Yeah. So we expect all countries and leaders to put their national interests above everything else, and that happens, right? But when you're a superpower and you're hegemonic, you can afford to give a little here and there in order to really establish yourself. I mean, look, the Americans. I mean, it's extraordinary that anybody should think that America has been meek in the 20th century. Ah. Never mind post-war. It has tried to assassinate political leaders around the world. It's funded, covert wars. It has destabilized governments. I mean, and also done just the opposite, promote democracy and rule of law and all kinds of things, right? Mm. So it's an extraordinary thing that the definition of America First today includes this kind of bad behavior.
Well, see, I recall a visit by former President Barack Obama to Saudi Arabia, and there was a picture of him bowing ever so slightly to the King of Saudi Arabia. And I remember when that picture was released, the Republicans just got mad and said, ha ha, yet further evidence of us, well, not us, but them, right? Again, kind of playing subservient to other global leaders when really they should be out there waving their American flag bold and proud and, you know, championing the whole American first slogan, you know. So it's those kind of rhetoric and it's those kind of narratives that's really driving the Trump base, really.
Okay. We'll be back with a look at a public relations exercise and ask whether it could be a genuine exercise towards a dialogue. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Bruce Springsteen and Dancing in the Dark. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han, who's not dancing in the dark. He's in a brightly lit studio in Banda Utama. Okay, now you can be part of this conversation at any point in time. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Hmm. Now, I don't know about you, but at our office at BFM, we have a regular meetup with our managing director, and we call it a town hall. Mm-hmm. And it's a very American thing. Han, when you were in the US, did you ever attend a town hall?
Yeah, a couple, but mainly on college campus, though. I wasn't really active in the community where I worked at post-college. So a couple.
Yeah, so what is a town hall? You know, is it just simply a building, which is what some people might think it is? It's a day one riot.
No, not quite. So it's a gathering of the various stakeholders, you know, around a certain agenda, right? If they're there to perhaps get feedback from the stakeholders about policy they're trying to push or a new measure that they're trying to impose, you know, so just trying to get what the grassroots is feeling or thinking.
Okay. So what, and I think it's kind of entering into the Malaysian lexicon, at least in terms of the media. The media is now using that as a way of signaling precisely what you're talking about, those dynamics. Now, the police, the Royal Malaysian Police, will be organizing town hall meetings in Kuala Lumpur to obtain community feedback and to strengthen their relationship with the public. This was announced, I believe, yesterday. Now, there are six districts where this is going to happen: Putrajaya, Cheras, Wong San Maju, Brickfields, Sentul, and Dang Wangi. Mm. Now, the question is, how can these town halls be constructed in order that it's a genuine dialogue and it's not just a PR exercise? Because, Han, I've been to a police town hall now held in my neighborhood in Section 17 PJ. And I thought it was quite extraordinary because there was a huge turnout because there are problems in the neighborhood. And the head of, I think it was the head of the district, you know, and he spoke to us. And then he closed the session. Oh. He took no questions and he didn't seek to have a dialogue. What he then did was to direct all of us with complaints to a counter where there were officers who would take down your complaints. Interesting was I then jumped onto the stage and went and sat right next to him and told him directly the problems that I had come to talk about.
Look at you and your activist impulses.
And he was very polite. He was very polite. And not just me. I mean, there were other people who were interested. Mm. And I think we'd come with these expectations.
Right.
Now, I was then told, well, very good, young man. And, you know, well, he didn't say young man because I'm not. And then he directed me to that counter. And I gave all my complaints. And this had to do with police extorting money from migrants, police sitting in front of illegal gambling dens late at night. And also the fact that when my house was robbed, I didn't get any follow-up. Mm. Now, weeks later, I received a form letter from the police because it seemed like it had nothing to do with my perspective. They just thanked me for my participation, and that was it.
Okay.
There was no follow-up on any of the complaints I had, and there was, in fact, no way of which I could make reference to the complaints I had lodged.
Now, well, here's the thing. Do you think any of your complaints were, say, new, though, or something that was of major revelation to the cops? Because I would think that...
I don't know. Oh. But the thing is, I can't even follow up. So is the complaint when you can't follow up?
True. And I guess going back to the idea of whether, you know, what really constitutes a productive town hall, right? You would think that in an ideal situation, you would be able to give out feedback and the various stakeholders can reach some kind of consensus and then the police can act on it. Like this just assuming on one issue. Okay? Obviously, there'll be a plethora of issues that any given community will have to deal with, right? So that would be the ideal situation. But you kind of, I mean, you can't help but think that this has got to be some kind of PR exercise. Look, let's face it, the cops here in Malaysia, they are in, you know, bad need of some kind of PR, because very often, especially in urban circles, the authorities are stereotyped. Right, and I guess any kind of engagement, being able to show themselves as relatable and real people, might, you know, earn them some PR points.
Actually, we don't want them to be real people. We want them to be professional. So, for instance, when my because it's not about a personal issue. It is about them acting in a professional fashion. So, for instance, you know, when when my house was robbed, we extracted, I personally extracted images from the CCTV. So I had images of the robbers. Now, the police did nothing to, in fact, do that. So then I voluntarily went to the police station and gave them the images. And, you know, and they thanked me, and they made some curious remarks. But never mind that. A month later, they had not circulated the images of the robbers to their police patrols. Mm. So I thought that was quite extraordinary. Here I am as a citizen and a victim making the effort. And instead of using that material, because you'd think that this was material, right? I mean, if you have an image of, very clear images of the robbers, you'd want to plaster them all over the neighborhood so everybody's alerted to these potential suspects in a crime case.
Right. You know, I have plenty of sympathy for you, Sharad, but, you know, based off of conversations I've had with former colleagues here in Malaysia who are currently serving with the police, and also, you know, college mates who are, you know, serving with the security forces in the States, etc. Look, from their perspective, they just get inundated with a whole bunch of data, a whole bunch of crime. They just flared out, and this is just the simple rationale. They don't have the resources to pursue every single case that comes across
their
desk.
Yeah, but what I do also notice, interestingly enough, and this was related to my other complaint, extorting money from migrant workers. This is what I view. I saw two young police officers try to extort money from migrant workers. I know because I asked, I talked to the migrant worker after that. And
no excuse for
so
that.
So if you had no time, perhaps if you spend less time trying to extort money from, you know, poor workers, maybe you'd have time to do your job.
It was only as simple as that.
Okay. Next up, and taking us all the way to the first bulletin of the morning, Bella and Sebastian with The Boy with the Arab Strap. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Pat Benatar with Hit Me With Your Best Shot. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. And thanks to KV Soon and Adrian Tai for hitting us with their best shot. They tweeted in response to the story about Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States, who didn't stand up. And I'm going to read what KV said. He said, misguided political stance. Some head to the Olympics to win medals, many to build experience and make friends. Only one goes there to make enemies. Missed the whole point of sportsmanship and cooperation and the opportunity for hashtag reconciliation. So KV Soon there, not impressed by Mike Pence.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, really Mike Pence was there to make enemies per se, but, you know, he was, well, I think one can safely assume he was there to make that send a political message when he chose not to stand for any other country except for the States. But, you know, is the Olympics really political free? Because if you are politics free, because if you go back to that defiant display by Jesse Owens, right, when he raised his fist up in the air after winning his event, I can't remember which one it is now. So you've got this history of political messages being sent out, via the athletes. And I guess this time around, it's different because it's not an athlete. It's a politician from the stands. And in this case, a politician from the world's largest economy.
Okay, well, what I remember, Jesse Owens was the runner, Olympic runner, who won a gold medal at the 1936 Olympics, right? I think it's quite different from the American Olympians who were Black Panther supporters who raised the fist. The raising of the fist had to do with the 70s politics in the US.
There wasn't Jesse Owens.
Jesse was from the 1930s. And do you remember? In fact, you know, Jesse Owens came to Malaysia, believe it or not.
Really?
He did in the 50s. Wow. And I know somebody who was a young boy who eventually ran in the Rome Olympics, and he met Jesse Owens in one of these displays. But It's just the Jesse Owens story is quite different from the Black Panther
right.
fist.
Sorry, I got my.
But it's interesting you mentioned it because if you remember the 1936 Olympics, if you don't, because you know many of us weren't alive, and some of our parents weren't even born. Mm. It was the Olympics in which you know Adolf Hitler presided over, right? So he definitely wanted to send a message of Aryan supremacy. Mm. The fact that Jesse Owens won the gold right. medal was a slap in his face on that. But again, you're right. The Olympics isn't politically neutral, but I think we expect our statesmen to rise above what. The normal rancor and competition, and so the Olympic spirit is an attempt to counter the politicization right. of the Olympics.
But are you surprised, though, you know, given the overt stance of the Trump administration, and it looks like Mike Pence is just towing the line, though?
Well, yes and no, right? And he's towing a Trump attitude towards diplomacy. He's, you know, so this is the man who would say, my button's bigger than your button in response to, you know, tensions in the Korean Peninsula, right? He's lowered the tenor. He's lowered the tone of politics, and people like Mike Pence follow, you know, happily along. Well, you know, and the question... with that, of course, is issue of, you know, governments, right?
Right. And so on Friday, Second Finance Minister Johari Abdul Ghani, that's the Second Finance Minister of Malaysia, said that any government in the world will be the, quote, best punching bag for its citizens. So I guess despite any kind of policy that they may roll out for the good of their people, it appears that that term government worldwide, you know, across many economies, have become a rather toxic term. You know, right before we came into this talk set, I was trying to think of, you know, was there anyone I've met over my travels who actually was glowingly positive about their own government? I don't know, Sharad, have you met anybody like that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, really? Not glowingly, but I think people can have a measured response to their governments. I think it's particularly tricky in, say, a country like Malaysia, right, where the government itself sometimes sets itself up for expectations that are unrealistic. And that's because we have what I think is adequately called a petitionary culture, right? So we have in this country the attitude that government's always doing something. So it's, you know, when politicians dole out money, it's as if it came from their own pocket. And we know it doesn't. It comes from the public's purse. It comes from taxpayers. It comes from our resources, right? But they act as if it does. So they make themselves the center of everything. They promote themselves as if they are the only real stakeholder in terms of solving problems. They don't empower larger society. Because to empower larger societies is to make themselves irrelevant. And so then when people have unrealistic expectations and blame them for the failure of things, who's to blame?
Well, I think very often in this narrative, the idea of the individual gets lost, right? Personal responsibility. But it's so convenient to find this scapegoat and the government's at fault for this, that, right? And just absolve yourself of blame. And I think I see that trend, you know, in my discussions with many people as well. And I actually recently, in one of my recent trips, met an Italian who actually moved to Singapore and said, you know, he's just fed up with democracy and having all these protests. He just likes something, albeit like a lot more authoritarian than what he's used to at home, but at least it works, you know. So you have this...
Well, coming from Italy, where I think they've had over 40 governments since the end of the Second World War, you can see why people might be...
Talk about political fatigue, you know, that's a whole different level.
Absolutely.
There.
Tell us what you think. Do you think we expect too much of our governments and then, you know, blame them unnecessarily for things when they're actually not their responsibility? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Include your name. Also, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with a look at a new and unknown language been discovered. Or has it? BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Aretha Franklin and Good Times. I'm Shaw Kutin with me at Tan Chung Han. And you're listening to The Morning Round. We're taking you all the way up to 10 this morning. Now, one of the big news items last week was discoveries are very exciting because it's always like something unknown, right?
Right.
So apparently, some Swedish linguists working in the state of Kelantan say they stumbled upon a previously unknown language, and this was spoken by a community involved in hunting gatherings, or the basic, that's their economy, right? Mm. And the language known as Jade is used by some 280 villages and was discovered when these researchers were looking at a different language, a Jahai language group in the same area.
Yeah, so the U.S. magazine Science News quoted the researchers, Joanne Yeager and Niklas Berenholt, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly,
saying you make that, it sound like a new language.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can just make Swedish, up anything we want to right now. Okay. So apparently those anthropologists had studied the villages there before but had missed the language. So second time around, I guess, they stumbled upon Jedek, or so they claim. The researchers realized that the villagers were using words and also grammatical structures that are not used in Jahai, and some of these words suggested a link with other Orang Asli languages spoken far away in other parts of the Malay Peninsula.
Now, so to get a deeper insight into what this discovery might mean, we spoke to Stephanie Pelagia, professor at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Malaya, but she had some reservations on this so-called discovery.
Okay, it's been all over social media and even our local newspapers that two scholars or academics from Lund University have found this new language called Jede in the north of Peninsula Malaysia. On our part, from the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics, University of Malaya, we can't verify because we haven't really seen the data. I'm trying to get access to the paper that they published because we're not sure whether it is really a new language or whether it is a dialect of Jahai.
We then asked her, what is the Jahai language?
Okay, so Jahai is the language spoken in, it's kind of the area bordering on Thailand on the north and then Kelantan and Kedah on the other side and even a bit of Perak. So I think they're a very small community. So we're probably talking maybe less than 1,000 speakers or 1,000 people of the Jahai community. So they are one of our indigenous communities in Peninsula Malaysia.
Now, the next question we asked Stephanie was, you know, how do linguists know when a language is new?
I think it's really important when you start a media initiative like this to have a reliable media partner with you. So when we started Popet Popet in 2014, we did a joint venture with...
Yeah, so sorry for that. That was the wrong clip. We go back to Stephanie and the question of what a new language is and how do linguists even know a language is new?
Okay. We would normally look at neighboring languages and then we look at how similar the linguistic features, for example, the words that they used, pronunciation, the sort of the grammatical structure. We also look at influences of the contact languages. So if they are close to, say, a Malay dialect, like in the case of Jahai, they border Kelantan, for example, whether there's influence from Kelantanese Malay. Yeah, so we would have to look at all that and then we would determine whether this is actually a dialect or is it like a totally different language. In the case of like, say, Cheik Wong, which is also spoken sort of in the area of Pahang, northwards, we have found that even from one village to another, you can have differences, yeah? But they're not separate languages, they are dialects of each other, yeah.
And finally, we asked Dr. Pillay what she thinks, if she thinks rather, there's still plenty of languages in Malaysia to be discovered.
It's hard to tell, right? Because I think we know our languages. It's a matter of whether they've been documented or not. It depends on what you mean by documented, because often it is like linguists and anthropologists going in and then writing down or recording these languages and the cultural practices. And then they write about it in books and academic papers. And that's about it. But that doesn't mean it's documented in the real sense because no one has, or no one, I wouldn't say no one, but We don't have access. The majority of the people, including the community members, have no access to these so-called documents. And that's not a good thing, right? So if you talk about proper documentation, you should also talk about an archive which is accessible to the public. And in that way, no, we don't have an accessible archive of our languages.
That was Dr. Stephanie Pillay, Professor at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at University of Malaya.
Oh, that's a bit of a dampener there. You know, you were kind of hoping that, wow, we have this yet undiscovered corner of the Malaysian fabric that, you know, yeah, you know, we finally, you know, found it. Well, at least those guys claim to have. And then now you've got Dr. Stephanie who says, well, maybe not quite. You know, she right. has to go ahead
well,
the paper.
I think she's being cautious, right?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's what we expect our academics to be, cautious and waiting for all the information before they weigh in on things. I mean, the media kind of forces everybody to take a position immediately, and maybe she's resisting that.
Well, it got us talking.
You know? It did. Yeah. And, you know, I think for a lot of us who don't understand the Orang Asli communities, in the plural, of the peninsula, you know, it's again a reminder of their presence and how important they are to the fabric. I studied anthropology. So, you know, for me, you know, and in particular, one of my professors, his work was on the Temiya people, you know, who are there in the Central Range and of course in Kelantan. And so, you know, I have and continue to have a fascination with this community.
And are the, you know, from your studies, are the differences between these various Orang Asli communities, are they vastly different or do they have some kind of common thread going through all of
well,
them?
Well, actually, so you look at the linguistic evidence, Han, it is fascinating. It's they're so-called three major groups of Orang Aslis in the peninsula. And, you know, you could spend a whole day and maybe listen to Night School. We did, in fact, a show on Night School about this with Kamal Sohaimi, who teaches at the same university as Stephanie does. On understanding the Orang Asli community. But, you know, one of the communities, one part of that three-part segment, their language has a Mon-Khmer base, right? So if you think of the Mon people and the Khmer people and the linguistic links are there, quite different from the Malay base of the language.
Yes,
so,
I have to check out that podcast on the BFM.
Yeah, I'll tweet it out. Nice. Okay, now taking us all the way to the top of the hour and the next bullet in the morning, The Naked and the Famous with Young Blood. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. It's just 6.5 minutes after 7 in the morning. It is the 12th of February, 2018. A short month. I believe we only have 28 days this month.
Yeah, short month and also a short working week. 4 days till Chinese New Year,
but
if you're keeping score.
And you should. Because yes. What if, Han, what if we had four-day weeks every week, every week of the year, meaning 52 weeks a year, and they're all four-day weeks.
Three words.
Four-day week. Yeah.
Three words, sign me up.
Okay, sign you up. Well, a company in New Zealand, which is a little ways off from Malaysia, is on the cusp of granting its employees the ultimate work-life balance with this, not just a four-day week, but a 4-day, 5-day pay week. Right, so you work for 4 days, but you get 5 days worth of pay. Because you can imagine, let me say, yeah, I'll give you 4 days, and we'll dock your pay along with it. You know, but anyway, Perpetual Guardian is a trustee company. It's been the first major business in New Zealand to embark on creating a workplace fit for purpose for the 21st century. Mm. Now, last year, the Autonomy Institute made renewed calls for the implementation of a 4-day work week, saying it would help out even out the unhealthy distribution of work and shift the focus to producing better work in a shorter time. What do you think?
Well, I, as an employee, I would certainly welcome this, a full pay on a shortened week. Obviously, employers, maybe not obviously, but I would think that employers might give a little bit of a pushback to this idea, you know, because, you know, question marks about productivity and output, and et cetera, if you're still using on that whole industrialist model. You know?
Okay, so what we need is evidence, right, about the claims being made from either side, whether, you know, bosses don't like this because they think that people are not working hard enough, or people who are advocates of this saying, well, actually, it's going to be good. Now, apparently, the last 2 years, a Swedish care home trialed a 6-hour workday with a mixed result. The benefits included a 10% drop in sick leave and higher job satisfaction, but overall increased costs by some 20%. So, okay, so we still, maybe the jury's out in terms of the in terms of the cost-benefit analysis of such a policy.
Right, and I also believe that on this show we spoke about another ad agency, I believe, who had trialed this as well, and they in turn have said that their trial has yielded or produced good results, and they're seeing higher staff retention, and also customers are just happier with the output as well.
Okay, so to get more insights into this experiment, we spoke to Shankar Santhiram of EQTD Consulting, a regular guest on the Enterprise show. We asked him just how realistic this model is.
I think this work model is incredibly realistic, to be completely honest, because I have been doing this at my company since November of 2016. We're still on a five-day work week, not four-day work week, but we are on 30 hours a week because my employees come to work at 10 o'clock in the morning and leave at 4. I can happily tell you that in my isolated instance, that we have seen an increase in productivity and an increase in revenue, bottom line revenues in 2017 by about over 19-20% since 2016. And I partially put this down to the fact that my team is a lot more inspired and engaged at work because of this issue.
Now, we asked Shankar what sort of understanding is needed from both ends of this relationship for this type of model to work.
Well, firstly, I mean, I was acutely aware that there were pros and cons in doing this. The cons were the fact that, you know, for me as a small enterprise with a consulting company with only 6-7 employees, it is very different from, say, for example, a much larger organization that has 200, 300 or maybe 1,000 employees. My model works because it's small and it's, I have a very flat organization, which means everyone who works for me is a direct report. Therefore, it's very easy for me to inspire and engage them to understand why they need to behave or what is the modality of behavior that is required for this kind of maturity in terms of a six-hour workday. There are some businesses, for example, that will not or cannot operate along these lines. So, by and large, if you're not in the essential services, I think this model works. There is an argument that 6 working hours a day is not enough, you know, if you're a surgeon or a barrister or a school teacher, etc. But for the rest of us, it's perfectly fine. The other con, which I was quite acutely aware, is the trouble with that you would have with competitors. For example, if other companies in my sector open until 7, 8 o'clock at night, and then there is a possibility that people trying to reach me can't reach me after 4 because I've closed the office, they might go to somebody else. But again, a certain amount of self-efficacy and understanding and purpose drive helps you organize this. The benefits far outweigh the cons for me. I find that my employees are now less exhausted. You know, sleep deprivation is a real problem for a lot of people right now. I also find that there is an improved recruitment and retention. The people who work for me don't leave now. They want, in fact, I get a lot of people applying for jobs.
We also asked him if he thinks Asian employers are more open or would be more open to such a work model.
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, are Asian employers open for these types of things? Asian employers are open for anything that will make their money. Let's be absolutely clear about this. That's the business model that we use in this part of the world, as is the same as any other business. It's a value proposition. At the end of the day, if an Asian employer is made to understand or cognizes the fact that the value proposition is very high, if you have engaged employees because they are working shorter hours and they can produce better results for you, they will accept it. Right now, this whole idea that Asian employers won't accept it, it's not the fact that Asian employers won't accept it because there's some strange behavior patterns that we have in this particular part of the world. It's simply because we want better bang for our buck. Essentially, every employer wants that. I do this for a living. I consult, I coach, I spend a lot of time with employers, and all of them are just worried that their productivity levels will come down. So when I can show them that your productivity levels actually increase when you give people better work-life balance, your bottom-line profits increase, Asian employers will turn like everyone else. It's just a question of creating enough evidence to show people that this actually works, to give them enough data and analytics to tell them that doing this will work. So instead of debating whether this works or not, we should be inviting researchers in Malaysia to actually show the effects of reducing down work hours so that people actually become productive.
That was Shankar Santiram from EQTD Consulting.
Yeah, and not everyone apparently shares the enthusiasm for that four-day work week as demonstrated by Shankar there. I'm reading this article on CNN.com, quoting a professor of public health at the Ohio State University, Ellard Dembe. And in his research, it appears that this whole four-day week, this notion of a four-day work week, it's not all it's cracked up to be. There are some there is some downside to it. So the idea that perhaps compressing a full work week into 4 days actually overburdens the staff members, not to mention the costs or the repercussions on the business as well in terms of cost, right? So there are some negative effects.
Which is something that Shankar, acknowledges, right? There are pros and cons. The question is, if every model has trade-offs, what set of trade-offs would you opt for?
Well,
And that is the crux. It's not about finding the perfect solution. It's about finding one, especially one that conforms to expectations that have emerged. I mean, who was talking about work-life balance 30 years ago? Today, it's on everybody's lips.
Actually, according to this CNN article, this idea of a four-day work week has been mulled by authorities of various communities, even from the 1970s. So it's not exactly a new notion. But for example, the state of Nevada, they tried it. Guess what? They had to turn back. Likewise, the instance that you mentioned earlier in Sweden, they tried it out. Yep, didn't work. They had to reverse course.
Well, so there's mixed results. The question is, when I say it's on everybody's lips, these are expectations that ordinary people have, not just advocacy groups, right? It's become part of the conversation. Well, speaking of conversation, we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.